everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Here's to a wonderful 2014. And I'm in a very chilly spot on the universe, in the universe right now, 10 degrees here in New York City. It's fun when it's cold, whether you're in or out. And I wanted to mention a few things before we get into the main part of the program. Robert Goodland, does that name ring a bell? He died on December 28th, and I wanted to mention him because I've had him on this program, and he was a wonderful environmentalist, researcher, writer. Perhaps you remember when the Food and Agriculture Organization put out this groundbreaking report in 2006, and they said that 18% of human-induced global greenhouse gases were caused by animal agriculture, and then World Watch Institute in their magazine put out an article by Jeff Enhang and Robert Goodland later on reevaluating that study, and they said 51% of human-induced greenhouse gases are caused by animal agriculture. And since that time, there's been a lot of back and forth about how that's right, how that's wrong, etc. I'm not going to go into it there, but Robert Goodland has written many wonderful works, and I just invite you to visit my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. Go to the front page and click on Remembering Robert Goodland, the Conscience of the World Bank. You can listen to my interview with him. You can check the links and see some of his writings. Let's just keep his work alive. It's so important, and it's so good. All right. Now, back to the living. I want to invite my next guest on, Dr. Michael Greger. He's a physician, author, and internationally recognized speaker on a number of important public health issues. He has a 501c3 nonprofit, nutritionfacts.org, the first science-based non-commercial website to provide free daily videos and articles on the latest discoveries in nutrition. There's so much more about Dr. Michael Greger. He's also the director of public health and animal agriculture at the Humane Society, and so much more. Dr. Greger, welcome to It's All About Food.
Thank you so much for having me on, Karen. It's great to be back.
I miss you. I haven't seen you in so long.
Well, you know, I'm going to be in New York this weekend, actually.
That's actually why I mentioned it. I heard you were coming up here. There's a big event happening with a lot of cool people talking about food.
Indeed. And yes. I am but one of many.
And you are. But it's all good. So where is that? When is that? How can we know more about it?
Oh, you know, I should have suspected you'd ask something like that. So it's at the Hudson Theater, Millennium Broadway Hotel, 145 West 44th Street. And one can get more details at therealtruthabouthealth.com.
Right, or your website, drgreger.org, which can lead you to nutritionfacts.org, which can link to your events. People can find you all over the place, including New York, in just a few days.
If I don't freeze on my way.
Please don't. Well, it's probably cold in Washington, too, isn't it?
It's pretty chilly, but I'm all warm and toasty inside, looking at all the poor suckers outside in the cold.
Okay, so let's jump into some nutrition facts. My first question for you is, in your opinion, based on fact, is there an ideal human diet?
All one can really do in terms of making decisions in life is based on the best available balance of evidence at any one time. And that may change as we learn more and more, but I think currently the best available balance of scientific evidence suggests that the healthiest diet, the diet most associated with longevity and the lowest rates of chronic diseases that are laying waste to our society, like heart disease, obesity, hypertension, diabetes, is a diet focused around whole plant foods.
Very good. That's what I always say. Excellent. So what about all those paleo people out there?
Well, you know, so the paleo people make this argument that, you know, human beings have been around for 2 million years, and just the last 10,000, just a blink of the eye in terms of geologic history, we've been, you know, eating the way we have with the advent of agriculture about 10, 12,000 years ago. But, you know, I think it's important, and that's an important perspective from an evolutionary biology perspective, but what they miss is that actually we as human beings have been evolving for the last 200 million years. From the Miocene era, when primates first started. And so for 99% of our evolution, from 200 million years ago to 2 million years ago, we were eating a diet centered around fruits and vegetables, centered around plants, dark green leafy vegetables, meaning leaves and fruits. And so for 99% of our evolution, our biology is attuned to eating plant foods all day, every day, all day long. And really, the blink in history is really just this last, 2 million, where we also incorporated some animal foods. But our biology, I think, is really tuned to that of our fellow primates, which is is shown by the kind of chronic diseases that affect people that eat kind of meat-heavy diets. One can make a better argument for a Miocenic diet than a Paleolithic diet, but regardless, they do have an important good point that, these processed foods, whether it be, Coca-Cola or sugary foods, really don't have a place in the human diet and, associated with all sorts of bad health outcomes. And so they're certainly right about getting rid of junk food. Even Dr. Atkins with the Atkins diet, right? He said, look, get rid of, don't drink milk and, don't eat Twinkies. Basically, anyone who says don't eat donuts is going to improve the health of Americans. That's not far enough.
Even vegan donuts.
And we really
donuts.
Need to move towards eating more whole plant foods in
even
general.
Vegan donuts.
Vegans used to be really healthy people.
Yeah.
Right? Because what could they eat? Right? They stuck in the produce aisle. Right?
Right.
But now, particularly those in Brooklyn, can gorge on amazing vegan junk food and can be just as unhealthy as everybody else, or almost just as unhealthy. Same thing with the gluten-free people.
Yeah.
The people with celiac disease, my patients with celiac a couple decades ago, they were forced to be healthy. They couldn't eat donuts. They couldn't eat cake. They couldn't they couldn't eat all this junk the American diet is centered around. But now there's gluten-free junk food, and they can get gluten-free donuts. And so now they can be as sick as everybody else.
As everybody else. Amen to that. Okay. Now, moving on. I think it's kind of linked to processed food, but I want to talk about bugs. So bacteria has been getting lots of press as we learn more about having them around, and some of them are good and some of them are bad, and some are kind of bi, where they go good and they go bad. Can we talk a little bit about them? Are you probiotic, prebiotic, antibiotic?
More importantly than there are certain, I've recently had a number of videos about prebiotics and probiotics. In fact, today I had a blog about the effects of probiotics actually on mental health, which is this new field of endocrinology that has to do with the effect of our gut on our whole nervous system as well, enteric neuroscience. In general, probably prebiotics are more important. So probiotics play a role for people in terms of treating antibiotic-induced diarrhea. my preventing and treating antibiotic induced diarrhea. And so for those people, I would put them on an acidophilus regimen, and we can talk about that. But for people that are not suffering GI symptoms, don't have diarrhea, don't have, chronic bloating, some of these other problems, well, then they don't need probiotics. They're bacteria fine. What they need is prebiotics. They need to eat things like fiber and resistant starch found in beans and found in whole grains that feed, that actually don't get broken down in our small intestine, end up in the large intestine, and feed our good bacteria so they can do what they were meant to do. And they produce all sorts of wonderful compounds like propionate and butyrate, which have anti-cancer compounds, actually circulate throughout our entire body and have all sorts of physiological effects. We have a symbiosis. We're kind of an organism made up of multiple different types of organisms, and we feed them, they feed us. But when we change our diet, we can dramatically affect the ecosystem down in our gut for good or for ill. In fact, this recent study got a lot of press. It was a letter published in the New England Journal that found that people that switch from a plant-based diet to eating animal foods get a kind of a boost in the populations of these bacteria that are associated with inflammation. And this goes along with that whole trimethylamine story, where carnitine, this compound in muscle foods, and choline, this compound in eggs in particular, but also in poultry, can be turned by bad bacteria in the guts of meat eaters into this something called trimethylamine oxide, which can cause inflammation and increase our risk of heart disease, all sorts of bad things. But if you take vegans and feed them a steak, which they actually had in this study, they took a longtime vegan, and they were willing, in the name of science, to eat a steak.
Wow.
They didn't create any of this toxic substance from the carnitine in that meal because they didn't have the bugs. They had not been fostering these bad bugs all this time, and so they didn't have the bad bugs in their system. Now, if they kept eating steak, then eventually they would slowly but surely foster the growth of steak-eating bacteria. But when you foster the growth of fiber-eating bacteria, then you get these wonderful bacteria that can have all sorts of beneficial effects, not only for our physical health, but our mental health as well, we're now finding.
And prebiotics, when we get them from food, are cheaper than probiotics in little capsules.
Oh, sure. And actually, by eating plant foods, we're getting both. I mean, these lactic acid bacteria, these lactic acid-producing bacteria, that's what makes sauerkraut. How do you make sauerkraut? You basically put cabbage in salted water. And so, don't you have to put a culture in? Don't you have to put bacteria in? No, the bacteria is found naturally on the leaves of cabbage. And the only reason you add the salt is to prevent the growth of other bacteria, bad bacteria, so it doesn't spoil. And so there are these probiotics, these lactic acid-producing, these like acidophilus-type bacteria found on produce, found on fruits and vegetables. So by eating fruits and vegetables, we get the best of both worlds. We get the probiotics and the prebiotics, and you're right, it's cheaper and it's safer as well.
Now, I'm going to ask you what some of your favorite discoveries were in 2013, but I just want to mention that one that I found out about that got me very excited was resistant starch.
Oh, neat. Oh, you haven't seen nothing yet. I must have at least 5 or 6 videos coming up in 2014 on resistant starch. I just touched really on resistant starch.
But isn't it like the greatest thing since, I don't know,
it's really amazing. So basically, this is talking about the benefits of legumes, the benefits of beans, peas, lentils, soy foods. These are we really need to eat beans every day. In fact, in the latest edition of Becoming Vegan by Davis and Molina, they even suggest eating beans at every meal.
Mm-hmm.
Be like the Britons and eat beans for breakfast because they're just so incredibly healthy. One of the things that's found particularly in beans and less so in other foods is this wonderful resistant starch. And they call it resistant because it resists digestion in our upper digestive tract and so makes it down and is able to feed our good bacteria and has all sorts of wonderful health-promoting effects. And it's really hard to get enough of it unless one is eating lots of beans.
And we don't even get the full caloric effect that we thought we were getting from them.
Oh, it has all sorts of neat. There's all sorts of neat. There's actually kind of starch digestion blocking enzymes, these amylase blockers within beans that actually kind of protect the starch from digestion. It has the kind of effect of some of these kind of starch blocker over-the-counter drugs that are sold, but without the bad side effects. Many of those supplements are actually made from white beans, they're kind of extracted from beans, but it's better to just eat the beans and get the benefits that way.
Okay, let's hear for the beans. Woo! What else was good in 2013?
You know, I'm glad last year I did a kind of a year of review blog talking about the most popular and most interesting videos of the year. I should do that again.
Yes.
I'm going to make a note for myself. 2013 videos. Oh, my God, there was such wonderful stuff. Such cool stuff. Remember that esophageal cancer and strawberry one? That was just insane. I mean, Dr. Dean Ornish and colleagues, the first to really publish about reversing heart disease, opening up arteries without drugs, without surgery, just a healthy plant-based diet and other lifestyle changes. You know, and that really was a revolution in the field. We could reverse, not just stop, but reverse our number one killer. So after, checking off, number one killer off the list, Ornish went on to try to reverse cancer. And successfully was able to treat men with prostate cancer with a vegan diet for a year. Actually saw a reversal in the cancer biomarker PSA levels.
Yep.
So that's really kind of the hot field right now is reversal of cancer and precancerous lesions. And so what this group did, they looked at esophageal cancer, one of our deadliest cancers. Unfortunately, it's found very late, and typically people just have a few months to live when they find out they have it. And so that's why this is the cancer you want to prevent in the first place. But basically what they did is they gave people a pound or two of strawberries, equivalent of a pound or two of strawberries every day for a couple weeks. So these were people with proven precancerous lesions, these dysplastic lesions in their esophagus that turn into cancer, and they were able to show that you could actually reverse the progression. So they were hoping, we could stop the progression so it didn't turn into cancer. But instead they went, and in half the patients, the lesions completely disappeared.
With strawberries.
With strawberries. Complete cases of complete clinical regression with, what was this magic miracle, drug? Well, it wasn't a drug at all. It was strawberries.
Strawberries.
And the reason that this isn't headline news everywhere is because there's no profit. No one makes money off of strawberries. If there was some drug, it'd be making some drug company billions of dollars, right? And we'd hear about it everywhere. There'd be ads on TV. But when that quote-unquote drug is just strawberries, which can't really be patented or branded, no one's going to – even a strawberry company wouldn't pay for promotion because odds are when you went to buy strawberries, you wouldn't buy their strawberries. You'd benefit some other strawberry producer. So it doesn't make financial sense to promote produce. That's why we never see an ad on TV for broccoli. So we don't hear about this stuff. And that's why I created NutritionFacts.org, because there's this tremendous science out there, this amazing mountain of evidence that just no one ever heard of. It's not that the science isn't there. It's just that no one knows about the science because there's no profit motive to get it out to the public, get it on the evening news. So that was why I created the site a few years ago, and it's been growing ever since.
Yay, Dr. Greger. Now, another thing with that is that most of us mere mortals do not have access on the internet that like some amazing medical doctors do, to some of the journals that are putting out this information. You have to have subscriptions. to
well, it
all
used to
of
be
these
even
things
worse.
And
so,
access,
I mean, before,
right?
There was a tremendous professional monopoly around this information, where, you know, doctors were the kind of, you know, complete mediators of this kind of medical information, and that there was just no hope for the lay public to make any kind of independent decisions about, you know, what the best available evidence was. Now things are better. There's a lot of so-called open access journals where you can actually read some of these scientific articles and studies that are coming out. Now, oftentimes they're written in kind of techno speak,
yeah.
And so it's jargon. So it makes it difficult for people, for the public to understand. But you're right. Still, there's kind of payment firewalls. Or paywalls, blocking access to many of the scientific publications out there. That's why you have to live biking distance from the National Library of Medicine here in Washington, D.C. The reason I live where I live is because I'm right next to the biggest medical library in the world, which essentially has access to everything. And so I, too, don't have access. I only have access because of where I live, but I'm able to bring that access to everybody and translate all that kind of medical speak and bring it out to the world, and I'm happy to do it.
Thank you. Now, I was reading in the New York Times this weekend about what we're dying of these days and how long we're living, and they were saying that we're dying less of heart disease and more often of cancer, and they're kind of catching up with each other.
In Canada, cancer is actually number one, and heart disease number two. I know this, you know, I give this talk on, you know, preventing, treating, or reversing the top 15 killers, and everywhere I go, I have to give a slightly different version. When I went up to Canada, I was surprised that actually, you know, I start out the talk talking about cancer, and heart disease drops down to number two. There's no reason heart disease should be anywhere on the list because it's a disease that can be essentially completely prevented in the first place, so no one ever has to get it, and it never need progress if you do have it, and can get on a good diet. It can actually be reversed in the majority of cases. And so the fact that it's a leading killer at all or a killer at all shouldn't be there. And so as people learn more about good nutrition, hopefully it will fall off the radar, and we'll be telling our great-grandkids about how there was this terrible scourge. People used to die of heart attacks. Our heart actually stopped beating. And then our great-grandkids go, no. And but yes.
Yeah, I look forward to that time. Okay, now I'm a big proponent of dark leafy green vegetables, and I get them every way I possibly can. And I think I've been quoting you for a long time, saying there's nothing that kale can't do. Did you say that?
Yeah. If I didn't, I should have.
I think
absolutely.
You did say it, and I think I've been quoting you anyway, or stealing it from you. But is there any time when you can get too much kale? Or too many greens?
Yes. Oh, too many raw greens, yes. Cruciferous vegetables have these natural, what are called goitrogenic compounds, which can interfere in thyroid function with people with marginal iodine intake. So what these compounds do is they block the thyroid uptake of iodine. But the answer is to not avoid these super healthy foods, but just get enough iodine in our diet. And so that's why sea vegetables are wonderful foods. We should all develop tastes. There's similar goitrogenic compounds in flax seeds and soy foods. And so, but again, we don't avoid those foods. We just make sure we get enough iodine.
And how do we do that?
These compounds are also destroyed by cooking. So if you, it's not something you have to worry about if you cook it. There was a case in New England Journal of Medicine. Actually, the title, the case report, was called Coma Induced by Raw Bok Choy. This woman ate about 3 pounds a day every day. So it's like about 15 cups a day for months. And she wasn't getting enough iodine. And so she actually ran into real serious problems, ended up in the ICU. But she had consumed about 1,000 cups of raw bok choy. I mean, so that's, you know,
I love bok choy, but that's a lot of bok choy.
You really shouldn't eat more than about 25 cups of coleslaw a day in terms of how much is in cabbage. But in trying to think kind of raw, cauliflower, it doesn't have a lot. So 50 cups, you shouldn't exceed 50 cups of cauliflower every day. Probably the highest is mustard greens. So about 3 cups of raw mustard greens is probably about the daily max on a regular basis. And, it's possible maybe people juice mustard greens. That sounds like a nasty juice. But, you could probably get more than 3 cups in, and so that's something you wouldn't want to do every day. We should not kid ourselves that foods that have pharmacological effects, real effects on our physiology, like eating kale actually improves our immune function. We should not kid ourselves that something that powerful couldn't have a potential downside if one overdid it. You can drink too much water, wash out the electrolytes in your body and run into problems. These are powerful foods, and we should include them in our diet, but, let's not go totally crazy.
Okay, let's not go totally crazy, but is there a blood test or something to check how much iodine we have?
No, you can check thyroid function. So it's something called TSH, a thyroid-stimulating hormone level, and you can make sure that it's not being pushed down or it's not getting elevated, which means that you have a hypoactive thyroid gland. But it's not something I would worry about unless one was symptomatic. Symptoms of hypothyroidism is like kind of the traditional ones are dry skin, dry hair, weight gain, fatigue. Unexplained weight gain, fatigue. These are kind of low thyroid symptoms. And if that's the case and you're, juicing huge amounts of kale every day, you're like, and not eating sea vegetables. Or if you are using salt, which I don't encourage people to do, but if you do use salt, use iodized salt because it's just an easy way to get your iodine in. Otherwise, it's not something I would worry about.
Well, I think it's not really a good idea to worry about anything.
I would worry about not eating dark green leafies. I would worry so much that you actually do eat dark green leafy vegetables every day.
Okay, Dr. Greger, what are you eating these days?
Oh, yummy. I'm eating let's see. So this morning, I had, this really, I take a pomegranate. Which is nice. It's pomegranate season in some parts of the world now. You take a pomegranate and you cut it hemispherically, and you open it up and then you whack it with a wooden spoon, get out all your aggression, and spit out the seeds into a little bowl. Then I added some unsweetened kind of Greek-style almond yogurt with some unsweetened cocoa powder to make kind of a chocolate pudding with the pomegranates. Added some pumpkin seeds, so I had this like chocolate pudding pumpkin, and the little seeds are like little explosions of juice. It was absolutely delicious. One of my favorite breakfasts during pomegranate season. This afternoon, I just had leftovers from last night, which was a big huge amounts of vegetables in a kind of marinara sauce on whole wheat pasta.
Excellent. Very good. Okay, well, I'm going to let you go. And thank you very much for everything that you do and for who you are. And check out nutritionfacts.org, right? And that's where it's all happening.
Keep up the wonderful work yourself.
Thank you. Be well. Hope to see you sometime soon. Stay warm. And thank you. Now I think we'll take a break, okay? And while we're taking that break, you might go over to Responsible Eating and Living and check out that post, Remembering Robert Goodland. And then we're going to be back with the Center for Food Safety's Elizabeth Kucinich. We'll be right back. Hello, everyone. everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and we're back for the second part of It's All About Food here on this very chilly January 7th, 2014. All right, now continuing talking about my favorite subject, food, only we're going to look at it a little differently now. And I'm going to bring on my second guest, Elizabeth Kucinich, who is with the Center for Food Safety. She's an experienced advocate and government affairs professional. And she was originally with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, where she advocated prevention over cure, nutrition over drugs, and human relevant research and training over the use of animals. And we're going to hear more about the Center for Food Safety with Elizabeth Kucinich. Thank you for joining me on It's All About Food.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
I met you a couple of Decembers ago at the PCRM Leadership Conference, and that was an amazing event. I was so inspired with what PCRM was doing and is doing, and the work that you were doing.
Yeah, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine is just a super organization. It was such a privilege to work with them for a number of years.
Now, Center for Food Safety is working on all kinds of issues that we talk about a lot on this program, genetic engineering and seeds and factory farms, organic food, food safety. What are you working on?
All of the above and a little bit more. So obviously the whole question of GMOs is a really hot topic, and there have been, obviously, as people I'm sure are aware, there's state ballot initiatives, and there are a number of initiatives that are coming up this year. People are filing them, so that's exciting. And then we've got, obviously, the federal legislation, which is the Right to Know Act. So that's the one question of GMOs and just the labeling, really. But we work on really a vision for food and for agriculture, which really is that the way we grow food and the way that we eat food is going to be a way that really sustains us and sustains the planet. And when we think of the way that we're growing our food now, I can't imagine that we'll be doing it in this way in 1,000 years' time. Can you imagine hundreds of millions of tons of chemicals that we put on our land every single year to grow our food? It's not sustainable in any way, whether it be because of the toxins that we're eating, the toxins that are going into our water, into our air, into our bodies, or just the fact that we're coming to peak oil and all these chemicals are petrochemicals. You know, they're made from oil. So there's lots of different things that we need to be considering. And so helping our society to transition to a truly sustainable food system is something that's really very, very important to everybody.
Now, this whole genetic engineering thing, I want to say it's a hot topic, and yet it isn't that hot in most people's lives, because most people aren't talking about it. They don't know about it. They don't understand it. And unfortunately, some people spread a lot of incorrect information about it.
Yeah.
And it's really messy.
Yes. Anything that's slightly complex is always going to be messy, and anything that is, has different people with alleged sides going against each other, there's going to be a lot of spin in messaging, and there's people who get confused in the middle. And so we really try to simplify things, but you know, basically on the GMO question, when it comes to labeling, it is that you have a right to know. We're not making any claims one way or another whether it's safe or unsafe. It's just you have a right to know what you're eating. From a personal point of view, my own concern is that the genetically modified foods that are out there, that are in around 90% of the processed foods that people eat, have been genetically engineered not to do something really nice and fluffy to feed the world and to overcome the challenges of climate change and drought issues, but really have been bred or genetically engineered for two purposes. One is to produce pesticides. So we have a type of GMO which is pesticide producing. And the pesticide itself is found in a number of plants, only not in the high concentration that it is found in the genetically engineered crops. And so this means that it is a pesticide, so it kills animals or kills pests that go onto it. But also it means that we are ingesting that. So what does that mean to our human health? Well, we need longitudinal studies on that. But people's own precaution could be that they can choose whether to or not to to choose it should that be labeled in a supermarket. The other kind of GMO that there is herbicide resistant. So that means that a plant can grow from a genetically engineered seed, and it can be sprayed with a type of chemical that it has been engineered to be resistant to. At the moment, it's glyphosate. Which is Roundup, if people have gone to their stores and maybe they spray their weeds in their garden, which I ask you please don't do that, but they do. But that Roundup then is sprayed directly onto the crop. And really for the first time we're directly ingesting those, you know, low levels of herbicides in our diet, because plants actually are able to withstand those chemicals.
They're smarter than we are.
So there's those two issues, and what's gone on from that, you know, we can see this starting this chemical warfare now. So we've got the pesticide producing GMOs, genetically modified organisms that are growing, and the pests that are meant to be dying from it. Now you see now over 500 different kinds of pests have actually become resistant to that kind of toxin. Mm. And so the answer to that, if you're looking at it logically, would be to increase the level of chemical that is engineered, so that we'd be, you know, producing more, it would be stronger, and the pest presumably wouldn't be tolerant to it immediately. But again, what would that mean to our health? Well, on the other side, when we're talking about herbicide resistance, there's many crops now that are many kinds of weeds that are resistant to this kind of herbicide, to glyphosate. So there's an estimated 80 million acres of American cropland that are blighted now with herbicide-resistant weeds. So again, the logical sequence of that would be that the biotech companies would engineer seeds and therefore plants that would be resistant to even stronger kinds of chemicals, and that's exactly what's happening. So Dow Chemical has now got a seed which has stacked genetic traits not only for glyphosate resistance but also for dicamba and 2,4-D. And I don't know if you know, but 2,4-D is a major component of Agent Orange. So the only reason why you would have a seed that's resistant to 2,4-D is because you intend to spray it with 2,4-D. And we can't see all of those chemicals be going into our environment. Into our food supply, into our water system. So we already know that so many, you know, swaths and swaths of land in the United States and communities are blighted now with groundwater, which is completely toxic due to chemical applications from agriculture. So whether it is looking at, you know, it from an ethical point of view, that people are uncomfortable with the technology, or from an environmental point of view, that the partnering with chemicals is unsustainable, you know, we really do have the opportunity to have our voice heard, and that is exactly what I try to do in Washington, is to, you know, help people to really understand what's going on and to have a stake in it.
From my point of view, when I talk about genetically modified foods, I like to steer away from whether it's good for us or not, because we just don't have enough information. But I like to steer towards what you were just talking about, the facts, the things that we clearly know that aren't working, and the fact that genetically modified foods enable us to continue all the wrong practices, and we need to change those agricultural practices.
Yep.
There was an article in the New York Times this weekend about what's going on in Kona, Hawaii, with a council member, Gregory Logan. Did you read that article or heard about it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, I like the New York Times, and I like a lot of the stuff that they talk about, but sometimes when I read an article and I, you know, scream at an occasional paragraph, no one hears me. and I appreciate this council guy trying to get the information, but I really – did he talk to you?
Actually, you know, the thing about that article is that they very selectively chose who they quoted in the article and quoted from the hearing. There was some, as I understand it, and I was not there, I actually wouldn't consider myself as qualified. We have wonderful attorneys and wonderful scientists that we work with, and they're the kind of people that I'd want to see really doing a hearing on this. But yeah, really good people were speaking at that hearing, and so for a journalist to choose some quite sketchy examples of what was said is really very underhand thing to do, and it's very sad that such a credible newspaper should choose to do that. And you know, to it was a very cleverly written article.
Yeah.
It was extremely cleverly written, that it seemed very, very reasonable. But when you do understand the facts of what's going on, and you understand what was included and then what was completely conveniently excluded, it was very sad. But anyway, we focus on the good things that are happening, which really is that Hawaii is mobilizing. And, you know, there's obviously a great deal of motivation. I mean, and the thing that Hawaii really does have to be concerned about is that it is a test bed for all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a direct threat to their environment and to everything that's going on. And, you know, being an island, that I'm sure that has some kind of bearing on the fact and the reason why biotech likes to go there. I mean, it's surrounded by a lot of water. If something goes wrong, then the chances of it spreading across are a lot slimmer than if you do something on the mainland. So what I got from that article is that obviously there's a lot of miscommunication, and of course from our side as well, there's a lot of people who understand innately that there's something wrong, but we really need to help people get to the facts and you know, be able to put the best foot forward.
Yeah. So how do our politicians learn, and how do they respond to you, and do they give you enough opportunity to present your side of the story, or the Center for Food
Well,
Safety?
You know, my husband, Dennis Kucinich, former member of Congress, before I worked for the Center for Food Safety, when he was chair of government oversight subcommittee on domestic policy, he held hearings on GMOs and on herbicide-resistant weeds and the superweeds, as they're termed. And so, you know, there has been opportunity. There have been discussions. It obviously is in the congressional record from a few years ago. And I think that what I really love, and I actually often mention this when I do events on the Hill, is that, you know, I'll get a congressional staffer that will come up to me, and it won't necessarily be because they've heard something, you know, because a constituent has rant and raved on a phone call or they've received some letters, but they'll say to me, why is my wife making me eat organic? And I'm like, yes, this is fantastic, you know, because the message is being received and people don't live in a bubble. So, you know, there's lots of different ways in which people receive a message and become interested in something. But the most significant thing for me as an activist and as somebody who works in policy is that food is such a great consequence to everything that we care about, ourselves being, you know, obviously right there first and foremost. Our physical health is obviously completely reliant on the food that we eat. And I'm glad that you mentioned the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, because they do extraordinary work looking at the opportunity to prevent and reverse disease through the food choices that you make, and partnered with, you know, the work that we do at Center for Food Safety, really looking at the way in which our food is grown to really try to make sure that it is as pure as possible and as least contaminated as possible. You know, that's very important. So from our own health to the health and well-being of animals, the environment, everything is connected to the food that we eat. And as an activist, it's immediate. You know, every time that you eat, you're making a decision. You're making a decision as to the way in which agricultural policy is moving forward and the way in which certain companies are making money. So if you're buying, if you can, locally sourced organic produce, then your money is going to something that is supporting where you want, you know, agriculture to move and where you want our food system to move. If you're going to, you know, a chain restaurant and buying something that's deep fried and highly processed, then, you know, that's where you're choosing for your money to go, and that's what you're supporting. So I don't necessarily support the idea of, you know, consumerism being the solution to anything, but the fact that we are consumers and have to consume food every day in order to live, you know, this is extremely convenient for a food movement.
It's the very least thing that we can do. Buy the food that represents what we believe in and is the best for us. Absolutely. Okay, so most of us are not really impressed with what's going on in our government these days. Is there anything good going on with food?
I Yes, I think that there is. We do have a lot of movement in the question of food. We do have a lot of members of Congress now really asking questions and very interested in what's going on. As I've mentioned before, there is the labelling bills and a number of other different things that are being worked on. And the general population really is helping to drive that. They're really helping to make sure that food starts to become front and center. And last year we had some very, very significant victories in the food movement where some very destructive policies were actually stripped out of bills because of the, I think now the political might that the food movement is showing that it has. So one of those things was what was dubbed the Monsanto Protection Act that was in the CRs. And that was, first of all, the initial one that got in was made so it was only relevant to the lifetime of the bill, which was 6 months. And then when they had to renew the bill, that provision was stripped completely. So, for people to really take on such big interests at such a time, in such a contentious political environment and win, I think says a lot for what we're really managing to achieve.
Is Monsanto really that evil?
I'm actually somebody who how can I put this? I don't like to think in terms of polarities. I think there's good and bad in everything. I think that, biotech has a most fantastic business model. I mean, if you're someone who believes in the bottom line of investments and shares and things, and you want to patent genes and you want to be able to basically monopolize over a food supply, you're onto a very good thing. For the rest of us, not necessarily a good thing, but for yourself, it's great. I think that there's ways of thinking about food and about solutions to problems that we have and about visions as to where it is that we want to move towards. And, as I said, I want to see a food system that really will comfortably take us into the next 1,000 years. It will be able to feed our growing populations, but also at the same time not be destroying our population's health by the methods in which we're producing the food. So,
does the Center for Food Safety have a vision of what that future looks like?
Yeah, so we see really, I think the basis really is organic as the foundation. So, at the moment we can think in terms of GMOs are obviously, as we said, a big button issue, but you can think in terms of them being the most contaminated because of the chemicals that they encourage to be partnered with the growing methods. Conventional, or what is quote-unquote termed conventional, can be anything. And so we can say that's moderately contaminated because we're not sure that the highest level of contaminants and destructive chemicals are actually applied to it. But many, many chemicals can be applied to and are applied to the fruit and vegetable that you eat under contaminated. And then conventional. And then as organic, it's not perfect, but it's as good as we've got under the labeling system now, and that is, we would say, that's minimally contaminated. And seeing as organic would be the foundation stone for where we would like to see the food system move, and on top of that, we would like to see appropriate scale, humane, socially just, so there's labor laws, and the workers really do have rights. At the moment, we see so many people who have pesticide poisoning and terrible effects from the different things that they've been exposed to whilst growing our food. And so there's a number of different levels to a food system, but everything that we do really, really works to those bottom lines of local, appropriate scale, humane, sustainable, socially just, and biodiverse. So they would be where we'd like to see agriculture go.
Now, I'm a vegan for 25 years or more, and I'm always promoting the power of plants. animal agriculture, CAFOs, what's your feeling about them, and is there any hope to not see them in the near future?
There are the very large companies like Smithfield who have said that they will outlaw things like gestation crates, albeit in a very, very long time. And you know, there's movement within the system that we see, but to be honest, it's not a sustainable system, and it's mm-hmm. a very big and unwieldy thing. And our government, you know, our tax dollars are really going to support the subsidizing of cheap feed and other different things that is obviously not sustainable. On the outside of that is a great externalization of costs. So all of the waste that comes out of these industrial animal factories is awful, and it's not processed like human waste is. They don't have systems that process the water. They're actually just put into big pits and left for some time and then sprayed on fields that are saturated. It goes into the water, groundwater, it goes into the rivers, it goes into the oceans. We've got the dead zones in the Gulf, in the Chesapeake Bay, so big environmental consequences, and of course absolutely abhorrent conditions for the animals. So we do, as a Centre for Food Safety, does work on litigation, does work on upholding environmental regulations and pushes for humane practices. But, of course, brilliant organizations like the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine really show people how, really, if you want to prevent and reverse disease, this is the way that you eat, and it's a plant-strong diet. It's one that's really based in eating foods that come from plants.
You mentioned upholding regulations, and I know that there are regulations that our government has and that very often they're broken, and either the government can't afford it or they just turn a blind eye, but even the ones that we have aren't often followed. How do we get them upheld?
Well, you know, we're in an interesting political time when government is seen as a very, very bad thing, and therefore regulation is seen as a very bad thing, except that when we realize that we need it to make sure that our food is safe and to make sure that our water is clean and things like that. So we need to start to really turn the debate on that, I think. So it's an enormous, enormous issue.
Yeah.
We work on a local, state, and federal level. So on a local level, we look actually at things, not only at pollution and the breaking of local environmental laws, and try to encourage people to take matters that are necessary. But we also look at zoning to actually prevent things from being built. We need to make sure that regulations are upheld. And the thing that CFS does is we litigate where the government refuses to regulate. So when the government isn't doing what it needs to do, when it isn't actually upholding the letter of the law and is encouraging, therefore, people to break standards, then we come in and really try to force the issue. So, but sadly, you know, it shouldn't be left to a non-profit to do that.
I know. And you can only do so much.
Exactly, yeah.
And there's so much to do.
There is so much to do.
Oh, okay.
It sometimes becomes overwhelming when you think of it.
Oh, no, I know.
Yeah.
All right. So we're...
CFS has had some great victories, so...
Well, that's good. So we can eat our plant foods. We can eat our organic plant foods. What else should we be doing?
Getting active. If people would like to sign up, come to our website, centerforfoodsafety.org. We are a very active organization. We have lots and lots of material on the website. We have shopper's guides and very practical things, but we also have activisty things. So if you want to get engaged and see what you can be doing either in your local area or federally, then, you know, there's resources for you there. So that's a really good thing. As I've said, not that I'm advocating consumerism, but every day you do eat. So, you know, choose wisely and obviously live within your means. But if there's a way that you can join a CSA, Community Supported Agriculture Program, where you support a local farmer, preferably obviously an organic one or one that uses the least amount of chemicals possible, that's a wonderful way to really support good things happening in your community and to also keep the money in your community so you're helping to bring jobs and keep your own community thriving as well as your health. But really just open your eyes, and you know, food is a very personal issue, and people often take great umbrage with people bringing it up, and it's not something that we need to force onto people, but I think there's an awakening happen, and just make sure that you get the facts, from places like the Center for Food Safety, and then, you know, let people know when they come to you. Share with them what you know.
We just have a couple of minutes, and I'm looking at the website right now, and I'm looking at your featured actions. Can we just talk briefly about Coca-Cola?
What would you like to talk about?
Coca-Cola and Monsanto having in common how they've been funding anti-labeling campaigns. Be careful what you're drinking.
Well, this is what, you know, what I'm saying is that where we put our money, the companies that we put our money in, is ultimately the policy that we get and the agricultural reality that is born, be it through the way that the companies themselves are directly growing or what they're putting their profits into.
But we don't, it's not that obvious. I mean, how many people know that Coca-Cola supported the Monsanto anti-labeling campaign?
Mm-hmm.
There's just so much out there that most of us don't know or don't have the time to know. And oh, goodness.
Look, it's an exciting world that one can explore and learn about.
There we go. Well, I think we're pretty safe if we're going for organic plant foods, minimally processed, whole, that
Absolutely.
We're avoiding most of the problems.
Yeah, because there's only five GMO crops out there, and so they're easy pretty much to avoid if you do go for that whole food, you know, plant-based options. Unprocessed, then, you know, most of the foods that you'll find, I'm sure, will be absolutely fine. And then again, if it has USDA organic written on it, and it's the little logo, it's a circular logo, then that's the logo to really look for. And that's, you know, a good basic standard to adhere to. So you know when food is not good for you to eat and drink anyway, so you should be regulating them within your diet. So
mm-hmm.
maybe not, you know, you might not be supporting the people at the GMA quite as much as maybe before.
Very good. Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food. Love your work. Love what you're doing. And
thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Have a wonderful 2014.
You too. Happy New Year.
Okay. Whee!
Future's bright.
Thank you. Visit centerforfoodsafety.org. There's so much information there that we all need to know about. And now we're at the end of the show, so thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. Have a very delicious week, and stay warm.